Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It's May 21st, 2021, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or, of course, at overthecap.com, where we really haven't had too much stuff to post about these days, but we'll get back to that sometime soon. I'm pretty beat tonight. I just had a long day. So we are doing one Michelob Ultra, and we'll nurse that one, I think, through the podcast here. Just definitely one of those days. Nelly is hanging out here as a co-host. Nelly, got anything to say? Nope. Nelly looks to be lounging around, so I'm sure she'll make some noise at some point in time. For those of you unfamiliar, Nelly is the bunny rabbit who has decided to come and stay with us now. So that's my little podcast co-host here. So not too much stuff here. Just a couple of things, and we'll do questions. So I think this one will be a much quicker podcast than usual. A couple of things I think in the works for the future, but I think for tonight, really the main thing to talk about just is Julio Jones. He's back in the news again. The Atlanta Falcons considering trading him. I think it broke in late April. It was right around draft time or so. Peter King was the first with the story. So he had spoken with me a little bit, too, just to make sure that the cap stuff was okay. So he had all the cap numbers in his articles were right when he originally wrote it. And I think what he had heard, and he's been pretty strong on you know, continuing to bring it up. I think the last time he maybe mentioned that it's like a 60% chance he gets traded. And I do not remember which reporter it was. It's one of the local Atlanta guys, and I just can't remember which one. Basically said that Atlanta is shopping him at this point, and they just haven't found takers anymore as of yet. A lot of people are kind of curious about this as to why the Atlanta Falcons would do it. I think the general consensus around fans, probably of the team, or just people in general, you know, viewing the NFL and viewing the team, look at this and say, okay, what purpose really is there to getting rid of Jones this year? Because if you look at the way that the Falcons have kind of constructed their team, they went with this concept of win now versus complete teardown. And that's kind of like a yes and no. It's a weird spot. You know, the Falcons were not a team that I think you could really give a yes or no answer to in any way, shape, or form when it came to what they were going to do this past offseason. Their salary cap was such a disaster. What they inherited right now, what had been building and brewing in Atlanta for the last 2 or 3 years, they were not really in a position to be able to do the things that, say, the Miami Dolphins did 2 years ago. Now, the Miami Dolphins a couple of years ago just gutted the entire roster, right? They just went out there and they got rid of everybody. Draft picks, non-draft picks. You know, if they could get something for you in a trade, they got something for you in a trade. If it meant paying part of the contract, as they did for Ryan Tannehill, they paid part of the contract to make sure that they got some draft capital back. If it was high draft picks at kind of lower impact positions, like a Minka Fitzpatrick, gone. You know, you bring in more assets. They took on a ton of dead money that year. I forget how much, but it was a lot of dead money. They kind of hit the emergency reset, completely tore it down and said, okay, when 2020 hits, we're starting new. We need a fresh slate. We're just completely tearing it down. We're basically turning into an expansion team and we're getting extra draft picks the way maybe an expansion team sort of would. And that's what we're doing. Atlanta's cap was so screwed. It was very hard to make a path for them to do that. When I looked at them in the offseason, there wasn't really a path to where you could say, all right, they could turn around and they could just dump Matt Ryan. There wasn't a path where they could just dump Ryan and Jarrett and Jones. It wouldn't work on their cap. It was just impossible to do. The way the team has been constructed in the last couple of years, it was complete and utter disregard for anything in the future. And it's understandable, you know, this is a team, it's a team that never got over that loss in the Super Bowl. You know, they never got over that. And it's hard, I get it. It's very hard when you lose in that game And when you're that close, it's hard to let go and look at reality and say, you know what? This was our year. It didn't happen. We've got this core. How do we kind of build around it a smart way? And they didn't do that. They just kind of kept doubling and tripling down on the same players while not really adding the right ones. You know, it was bad value in what they did. You know, last year was absolutely atrocious for them. Signing Fowler to the contract they did, compounding their draft situation by trading away a second round pick for Hayden Hurst. At least I think it was a second round pick. It was just the disaster, one disaster after another. Their situation is somewhat similar to the Saints in that there's going to be a point in time where the Saints, where it really goes bad for them. All right. Just like the way it went really bad for the Eagles this year and the way it's bad for Atlanta this year will probably be bad for Atlanta next year. You know, there's a lot of those things are probably going to come into play. But I think what happens with a lot of these teams is while the cap guys at times get credit, like we see Kai get a lot of credit in Philadelphia, the credit really went to Howie. It probably shouldn't have, probably should have gone to some other people. Though he obviously takes an active role in Philadelphia in that stuff too. That's his, you know, kind of his bread and butter. Nick Polk, who was with Atlanta for many, many, many years, he's getting, I think, in league circles, I think a lot of the blame for the Falcons cap situation right now. And that's not really fair. I don't think, at least, you know, I think he basically did the same things that other people at times get praised for. Tried to salvage a really bad cap situation from a team that just couldn't let go on anybody and continued to want to bring in. They pulled as many levers as they could to continue to do that and to continue to chase that Super Bowl loss, even though the team basically kind of spiraled out of control from there. Maybe really the better comparison to where they are, even though the quarterback is probably a little older than where Breeze was, it was those years where the New Orleans Saints went 7-9. I think it was back-to-back-to-back years, maybe. The Saints cap was screwed. I mean, it was one of those things where people didn't make notice of it as much because the Saints were just constantly near the top, but they didn't have like that catastrophe year. But when you looked at it, it was 2014 to 2016. The cap was a disaster. The amount of their dead money was crazy compared to the rest of the league. While it was probably the top of the league in every one of those years, even though it didn't have like that massive Miami Dolphins type season, it was just consistent. It was a consistent, we can't do anything major to fix this roster. And what they did major was they hit a home run in the draft, and that changed the fortunes around the whole team. But that was another team that for that period of time, I'm just pulling up the record here, you know, they basically chased this little period where, you know, they were great. They won the Super Bowl, then they go 11-5, 13-3, and then it starts 7-9, then you have the jump back 11-5, 7-9, 7-9, 7-9. Every year their cap just was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. They didn't get this kind of pull back on the cap that really, that was like a double hammer to the Falcons this year. I don't think they had anywhere that they could go. It was just like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. There was no good option. You know, door one was salary cap hell. Door two, salary cap hell. Door three, salary cap hell. Door four, still pretty much salary cap hell. There was no escape. There was no escape from the mismanagement, I think, of the last 2 years. I don't know if when they came in there now and they looked at this, they said, all right, we need to tear this down. We need to completely do this, because I don't think there was a way. Buffalo was in a very similar spot as well. You know, if you want to go to another team as well, when they brought in Brandon Bean, their cap was like this with a lot less talent. Maybe the talent wasn't as old, but it was not very good. They couldn't go in there and just gut the roster because those contracts were loaded with guarantees. The contracts were loaded with prorated money. You know, they had to go in there and try to negotiate pay cuts, try to restructure some deals. eat a lot of the cost by carrying players like Marcel Darius, you know, through the trade deadline, until the trade deadline, and then make a move for him. And just try to find ways to creatively navigate a really bad salary cap situation until they could turn things around. That's probably a little more like this. You know, Buffalo couldn't get rid of Tyrod Taylor. They couldn't get rid of Marcel Darius. They couldn't get rid of those guys at first. They had to kind of bide their time. I don't remember if Mario Williams was still there. He might have still been there too. It was navigating a bad spot. Similar to this, probably not as bad as this. Similar kind of situation where you were going to have to gut the roster, but you really couldn't do it all at the same time. You know, you just couldn't do it all at once. I think when people look at this, they look at the Falcons and they look at a couple things. One, they look at the dead money on a trade on Julio Jones. Basically, you have to account for $23.25 million. Now, there's a timing aspect of it, which is going to depend on when they move him. And when they move him, it'll be after June 1st. All right. That's when you're going to move the player because of salary cap considerations. But they look at this and you'll say, okay, it's $23 million to keep him on the cap. It's $23 million to not have him. So it doesn't make any sense to trade him. That's the first thing that comes in. Second thing that comes in is, well, look at what they did in the offseason. They double down on Matt Ryan. He's still going to be there. They double down on Jake Matthews. He's still going to be there. They still have Grady Jarrett on this team. They drafted a tight end instead of a quarterback. They're all in for right now. Again, I don't think that means you're all in for right now. You know, passing on a quarterback is never a good decision. I don't think, at least. You know, unless you are 100% convinced that that quarterback is going to be a bust, it's probably not a good decision. At the same time, if you're going to draft a quarterback, the benefit that you get from drafting a quarterback is going to happen if the quarterback is actually on the field for you, if not as a rookie, certainly by the second year that player is on the team. Because if you're waiting until the player's third year to get him on the field, you're not getting the benefit of a true rookie contract. It's one of those spots where you need them in there right away to take advantage of that low cost. Now, you want to have that ability to have a $30 million player that you're paying $8 million to, because that giant gap can go to, well, covering a really bad salary cap situation like we see in Atlanta, very similar to what happened in Dallas. You know, Dallas couldn't take advantage of Dak Prescott all 4 years on that low-cost contract because of, you know, the other bad deals they had on that team. But it basically let them offset the fact that they were going to have a ton of dead money for Tony Romo because they screwed that deal up. They basically, you know, it kind of offset. And the same thing could have possibly happened here. But I think when you look at Matt Ryan and you look at where they were with Matt Ryan, there was no way they were going to be able to move Matt Ryan this year. It was going to be near impossible. For them to hold on to Matt Ryan until June 1st to trade him, that's really not a normal situation. And they couldn't have handled that on their salary cap. I can't recall what his cap number was in the offseason, but it was probably like $40 million, you know, before they restructured his deal. Let's see, what was it? Matt Ryan, let me see if I can just do it real quick. His original number, let's see, he had a $23 million salary. There was probably 17 prorated, 17.9, I think was the proration on that. Just trying to back out all this stuff. So yeah, about a $41 million cap hit. They would have had to carry that until June 1st. Trading him outright would have cost them, let's see, it would have been 17.9 for two plus another 8.44 to move him before that. That wasn't feasible with their salary cap. If you did that with Matt Ryan, the only way out of it for their team then was to double down on Jones, find a trade partner for Jarrett, or double down on Jarrett, do a lot of these other same moves they did with Matthews and Jones and all those players. So again, you know, it's where you get to that salary cap. You know, that door one is hell, door two is hell. There was no out. There was nothing. You know, there's no way you could say that there was a different option for them. So the door that they chose was the door that was going to have Matt Ryan. And because of the salary cap charges for moving Matt Ryan next year to cut or trade Matt Ryan will cost them $40.5 million on the cap. That's actually a savings of about $8 million, but a $40.5 million cap charge for him. He's not going to go. I think that the team would have to be so bad, so awful for them to completely move on that I think they probably looked at this and said, given his contract, he's going to be here in 2021. He's going to be here in 2022. And at that point, how old is he going to be then? You know, when 2023 rolls around, 38? So, you know, then the question becomes, is he even tradable at that point to where you can really get value for him? So I think you look at this as a rookie quarterback and say, we're going to lose two of our years at least. You don't get that same value by having that rookie come in year three. So I think they looked at it that way. You know, they if you notice with Jones, they didn't touch his contract. And my take on this way, way, way back when was probably that the most likely option was keep one, trade one. It was very hard to see a scenario where you could get rid of both, but you could come up with a scenario for one. I think doubling down on Matt Ryan was just the reality that they couldn't afford to move Matt Ryan. You know, it's much harder to trade a quarterback as the season goes on. At least to get that kind of value for him. It was near impossible to hold him on the cap at his kind of numbers to carry it that long, whereas Jones's numbers were more realistic to be able to do that with. You know, a $23 million cap charge right now and trading a wide receiver after June 1st, not a big deal, and you'd free up $15.3 million. I don't think that they built this roster with this idea that they need Jones, Ridley, Pitts, and whomever else on the field to win right now, that they need those three receivers there. I don't think that's the case. I think the long term, very much in Atlanta, is obviously this tight end they think is going to be, you know, godly, and they need him paired with Calvin Ridley. Now, Jones is 32 years old. He's a great player. He has absolutely dominant games. But he's 32 and he has trade value and it's a contract that you can move. I think the long term, I think that there's a method to the madness here that is not all about being all in on 2021. I think it's finding what part they were actually capable of moving in 2021. Now, the problem for them is that you can't go and just take garbage for Jones. You know, you need a good offer. You can't have a bad offer. If you have a bad offer, you know, you just can't take that. You know, he's coming off a down year, just, you know, he was hurt a lot. So I'm sure there's some concerns there, but I mean, the guy's been dominant. I mean, it's 1600, 1800, 1400, 1350, 1700, basically 1400, you know, yards. Now, some of that I'm sure they're going to say is that offense they run in the dome and everything else. He's going to go somewhere and he would contribute. This isn't going to be Andre Johnson going, you know, to Indianapolis as long as he's healthy. You know, I don't think that would be the case. But now there's a little bit of a risk here because of the age, but you have to get something really good back in return in order to make that trade. Now, Atlanta's salary cap as it stands right now, they don't have the room to sign the rookie class. Not even close. So they have to create cap space somewhere. So that's another reason where the $15.3 million that's saved this year, even if you're deferring, how much would it be? $15.5 next year? Yeah, $15.5 to the following year. You are creating at least the room that you need for your draft class. Because right now, Atlanta would be, let's see. Atlanta has about $400,000 in cap room. Atlanta would be about $7 million over the cap to sign the rookie class. You can't go over the cap. So clearly, they need to make some moves. Now, if they don't go that route, you know, basically what they're going to have to do is, you know, restructure contracts then. What you would do at that point is if you go into like the calculators that we have, let's bring up the Falcons one here. Now we have to make up room, and we've only got a couple of players that we can touch because we've already basically maxed out our savings. The only two players we really haven't touched are Julio Jones and Grady Jarrett, which are probably the two players on a trade block right now. You would have to go in there, and let's say you restructured Julio Jones. You restructure him to the max without the void years. You would then have the room to get a player. The problem then is when you trade him next year, the number would be significantly higher because you've really increased the amount of dead money that's in that contract. You've gone from 15.5 the next year to, let's see, how much would it be? Yeah, it'd be $27 million to cut next year versus $24 million on the team. And again, you'd have to run that whole thing back with the whole June 1 thing. What would that do to their cap next year? Without the rookies even signed, it would push them to about 1.5 under. So, I mean, they'd be right up on the cap. You know, the other one is you do Jarrett. You know, you restructure that one. They probably don't have enough cap room to function this season. That would get them to 6.7 in cap space. And they need to have more than that because they also need room for the rookies. Basically, their best option for the now and the future is to trade Jones. Because, again, let's just going over the numbers here. So if they have to restructure Jones, they get up to $9.9 million in cap room before rookies are signed. And next year, they'd be at 1.4. That $10 million in cap space is probably just enough to barely function for the season. Most likely, they would have to restructure Jarrett as well. You do that, that moves into 5 over next year, 16 under for this year. You know, that would definitely give them the wiggle room to do that. But I'm sorry, 5 over for next year. I think I said under. But if they trade Jones, not only do you get probably a decent pick back. So if they trade Jones, June 1 trade, looks like our June 1 trade is not working. All right. Let's see what June 1, the cuts aren't going to work there either. He'd be 15, you'd gain 15.3. So you'd be at $16 million for 2021. And in 2022, you'd have 15.5 dead. You'd be at about $10 million under the cap on that. I'm just working through a couple of the things here. So I don't think I'm wrong on that. Yeah, so you'd basically be at 16 and then you'd be 10 under next year. So even though when you look at the salary cap number for Jones and you say 23 to keep, 23 to go, you have to, again, take into that long-term consideration because really what you're saving is the $15.3 million in salary that you owe him. That $15.3 million, even though, well, actually it would all hit the cap in a sense this year. You know, in the creation department, but it's $15.3 million that you would not have if you waited until next year to move him. And again, you're probably compounding your future cap situation by doing that. So I think from almost every standpoint possible, it makes sense for them to look to trade Jones. Now, Jones is very affordable because of the way the Falcons did this deal, which really was questionable at the time, you know, with the way that they went with it. The way that they did the deal was basically they had to be ultra confident that he was going to play at least 4 of the 5 years on this contract. So really 2 of the new years. There was no reason for them to reopen negotiations with him at all. Zero. This is what happens when you don't have a firm philosophy in place. You know, one of the things that you stress a lot is as an organization, you really do want to have firm things in place. And when someone starts bellyaching about a contract and they've got 2 years left, they're going to make a turnover past 30. You don't want to be reopening those contracts, you know, to make somebody happy. You just don't. So they got just bad decision. Let's just put it that way. If this was a organizational, we don't do deals unless there's 1 year left, the way the Steelers used to do. You know, we'll move some money around for you if you want, but we don't do deals. None of this would have happened. That's their own doing. Because of all the prepayments they made on the deal, His salary this year is 15.3, and then in the next 2 years, it's 11.5 each season. That's really affordable for a team. So not only is it, you know, is it a good player, he's pretty cheap. You know, all things considered, you know, let's see where his salary ranks those 3 years. So for 2021, ninth in the league, that's not bad at all. And then in the next 2 years, it would be 17th. Sorry, I keep sorting them by cap number, which isn't right. 17th by cash, because that would actually become the cap number for these guys. 12th the following year. And cap-wise, it would be lower in each of those seasons because there'd be nothing prorated with that if you were acquiring him. So the cost is cheap. Question is, what will they ask for? And again, you know, he's 30-something years old, great player. Question is, what do you get? This shouldn't be the same as the DeAndre Hopkins kind of stuff where, well, obviously that was an awful trade to where somebody brings that up where, you know, he was looking for a new deal. I think the expectation would be that Jones is not going to get another contract since he's got 3 years left on this one. You know, I think teams would definitely be willing to do it. You'd probably restructure his deal just to be able to fit him, because at this point in time, the only teams that can fit him are the Jaguars, the Jets, the Bengals, Broncos. That's really it. You know, when you go through, it's really just the Jaguars and Jets. The other teams, you know, once the rookie stuff is finished, the Bengals probably as well. For a lot of these other teams, when the rookie stuff is finished, you're close enough to where it would probably impact you once the summer is over and the cap accounting changes. So, you know, for these other teams to do it, you know, they would have to make some salary cap maneuvers for it to make sense. You know, I think what you would look for are teams that have flexibility in the future. Now, I don't think the Colts are going to be in the market for that. I think that would be a pretty interesting kind of trade because they have the cap room to defer the money to the future if they want to do that. I think that would actually be kind of interesting. Miami, they would have to do some tinkering in order to do that, but they do have cap room in the future. I don't see Washington being in play here. The Chargers are a team that has the space to do it. I think that would be interesting. He's an older player. They've got some older guys on that team. I think you could definitely fit him in. That might be a nice match for a young quarterback. I think that would be intriguing. Denver, I guess, could be intriguing. Seattle, no. Bears don't have the space to do it this year. That would be kind of fun. You know, the Bears would move money if they could. I'm not sure if the Bears could find a way to move money, but gosh, they would definitely do that. you know, I think those would be the teams. The Ravens would have to do some stuff, but I could see the Ravens. Ravens always like these. If you can get a trade on a, you know, a veteran type player like that, I think the Ravens for the right price would be willing to do it. You know, those are the teams I look at and say, okay, you know, I look at their cap this year, I look at next year, and I'd say, okay, that can make some kind of sense for where they are and what they need as organizations, what they're looking to do. The Falcons, the other thing for Atlanta, too, is they have to set aside a lot of money for Calvin Ridley. Now, you have to imagine that he's their long-term vision, so that 15-3 goes a long way towards putting some money aside for that. You know, and some of these teams obviously have extensions coming up. The Colts have extensions for players coming up. The Ravens have a quarterback who's going to get a bunch of money. But, you know, I think those are the kind of teams that would be in the market. Then the question is, what's your compensation? My guess would be like a second round pick. Maybe you could finagle your way into a first rounder in some way, shape, or form. Does that sound good enough, you know, from a Falcons fan perspective? I don't know. You know, you always envision your own players to be worth a lot. And he's a, like I said, a terrific player. I guess you wait and see, but the dollars and cents of it does make a lot of sense for Atlanta to do this. I think it makes a lot more sense than having to double down on him and Jarrett possibly in the next 2 months. I think it would be, I think it'll be kind of interesting to see as to what happens. Only other stuff really this week, I think worth talking about a little bit, and I was going to post on it, and I was just too busy, so I didn't throw it up there, but the Washington football team released, what was it, Morgan Moses, their right tackle. I'm not sure if I even processed that yet. Troy may have. Let's see. Yeah, he did. So, you know, this was one where you could see after the draft and, you know, they signed Leno as well. You could see the writing on the wall here. And this is, this kind of falls into the same boat a little bit as to, you know, what I'm talking about when it comes to Jones. The question that a team has to ask themselves, and I think too often they don't do this, you know, they kind of look at it sometimes like we do when you get into the cap charges and everything else. But if you look at Moses, Moses is going to cost, would have cost the team this year $7.75 million. He's a terrific player. We had him ranked incredibly high as a right tackle last year. I think we valued him at about 11.5 on our valuation metrics that we do. So, you know, really solid player. You know, one of the better right tackles, I think, certainly available this late. I mean, that's a terrific player to be available this late. You know, they drafted a player. You have to ask yourself, you know, people will say, well, what if the draft pick isn't ready? It's a risk. But where are you better off? Where are you better off as a team? Because what you have to ask yourself is the cost of the draft pick is sunk, right? You already know what that contract is going to be. So your options now are sit your draft pick. You know, at 100%, you're going to sit him probably, I would guess, barring injury, behind Moses. So it's a wasted pick for 1 year. And, you know, then you basically, you have Moses at 7.75, you know, or 8 million. Let's just call it 8. You know, so you've got him at 8 million. So you've basically spent $8 million on the position while having a guy sit for the year. Option, you know, the option behind door number two is to say, okay, we look at the rookie. Odds are he's going to play for us, and we go out and we sign a veteran tackle who, you know, Cameron Fleming is the guy they signed, and I'm not sure what they paid for him. I don't have the contract details on that one. Let me see if there's just anything online on that. But I would imagine he's under three. You know, he's a swing tackle, so he's probably, you know, you need a backup. You do need a backup tackle. Is it Fleming that they signed? Let me see. I thought that's who it is. And I'm sorry, they didn't sign anybody. I thought they did. So I'm thinking of Lucas, you know, who's kind of their swing guy that's there. You know, and he was going to be, you were going to have him probably as a backup swing tackle anyway. He only cost you 1.6 this year, two on the cap, 1.6 in cash. He was going to be there anyway. So basically, this is your reserve policy. This is your insurance policy, is a player that costs $1 or $2 million. Versus $8 million. That's a lot of money. You know, that's $6 million in savings that can go towards other positions on your team. You know, a couple guys on defense that you're looking to extend. Probably get your draft pick on the field this year. You know, again, this is like your emergency plan. You know, when the thought of the release stuff came down, Brad posted something on it. And I did a real quick look at the numbers, which I don't think I have here, but just as a rough guide, you know, if you looked at tackles drafted in round two, or tackles drafted even in round one and two, the numbers were pretty similar. Well, it wasn't really a big difference between the two. I think the median value was somewhere around 700 snaps played as a rookie. Let me see if I can find it. All the tackles drafted in round two since 2011. Average snap count is 632. Median was almost 800 snaps. And the top quartile of the teams was about 1,000 snaps. Those numbers I know were pretty consistent. Even if you put round one into it, it was close to 800 and, you know, maybe 1050 or something like that. So basically, you have to look at this. And one, you're ultra confident in your draft pick, right? You wouldn't have drafted him, you know, when you did if you weren't. History would tell you that these are players who are expected to play right away. You're not signing them to ease them in. You're signing them to play. If you have this draft pick and you know the draft pick is going to play, you know, it's different than a wide receiver. You know, wide receivers sometimes ease in a little bit more. You know someone is going to play. Why do you need an $8 million insurance policy or an $8 million block? because it's one of the two things. Either the $8 million is blocking you from playing your rookie, or you're wasting $8 million on a backup tackle when you can have a $2 million guy probably do the same job. So what's going to happen is if the player is a bust, if he's just not ready, okay, then you've got to go to your cheap guy. You know, that's the risk that you take. You know, and I think that is a absolutely fair risk, and it's the right way to do it because it's going to save you a good amount of money that, you know, you can use to better your football team. They're not a team that – they're a team that needs to get better. They got to be able to use their resources. With a lot of these teams, sometimes what you have to look at is what's the long-term impact? What's the impact that that player has on your roster for this season? How much does it really impact this season? But even when that cap saving doesn't seem that important this year, what does it do for the long term? You know, what does it do to free up a budget for other players who you're looking to keep or other positions that you're looking to sign? You know, Washington could sign some other players, you know, that maybe they could even use some help with this year. Most likely this is just going to go towards extensions. But, you know, I think that's just a way that we need to view contracts sometimes, and we don't. What is it? What is the player blocking? How much money is it going to cost to have him block somebody? How much money is it going to cost to have him sit behind somebody? And what's the alternative scenario, and what would that cost? And our cost here, really, I'm saying it's $2 million, but your backup swing tackle is going to be a backup swing tackle. It's basically $2-3 million no matter what you do. You probably were going to keep someone like that anyway, I would guess, on the roster. You know, if you were that concerned, I guess, about your rookie, which probably not. But in any event, you know, at the very least, you're saving $6 million this year by doing that type of move. And I think that's something when it comes to roster construction that is really important to look at is, you know, what's the long-term impact of some of the players remaining on the team, you know, where you kind of chase something. You know, like, I didn't think it made any sense for the Chiefs last year to keep Sammy Watkins, even at whatever cost it was. It's like you're chasing a bad contract, hoping that something dramatically different is going to happen with injuries. Now, maybe they looked at it as, you know, that they were a championship team. They wanted to keep as many players as possible. So you go and you do that. You know, I think the Browns probably made a mistake this year in keeping Odell Beckham. I think that is chasing something that's not really reality. It's chasing something that quite honestly hasn't existed for him in four seasons probably now. Yeah, he might be a good enough player. You know, and he might have a bounce back year. I don't think the stuff that made him special seems to be long gone. Now they're not paying him to be totally special or anything like that, but you know, you have to look at those things. You know, it's like when the Jets played Josh McCown $10 million to back up Sam Darnold. Like what are you thinking? Like in what world does that make any sense at all? Even if Darnold's not ready to play, in what world does it make sense to have Josh McCown, who's never made close to $10 million in his entire career in a given season, that you're going to pay him $10 million to potentially be the starter when you didn't even pay him that last year when you knew he was going to be a starter? That's stupid. And I think there's a lot of times where teams make some of these decisions that aren't in their best interest because of fear of total catastrophe. Those fears most of the time are pretty unwarranted. You know, there's always a risk, but I think you really have to look at the numbers involved sometimes when you make those decisions. And I think that was a good job by Washington, just looking at the reality of things after the draft, likelihood of draft pick playing, and what it would really cost to just have another backup on the team who, in the case of emergency, you know, ends up starting. I think that's a nice move by Washington. All right, let's jump into the mailbag here. We'll run through some questions, and then we will call it a night. I think I saw a couple things come in this week. I'm sorry, not this week, just today. I don't think this is for the podcast. I'll touch on it real quick. I'll try to remember to reply to Night Wines here. Curious, as I recall, the Chiefs were going to be on the hook for something like $25 million from Mahomes, but they restructured again this year to just $7 million. How many more years can they keep this up, and what are the pitfalls, if any, of kicking the can down the road like that? So Mahomes is under contract for 10 years, so they can keep doing this for as long as they want. When you're talking about a 10-year contract for a player as good as Mahomes at a position that plays until your late 30s, for the most part, there's really no danger at all. The danger comes when you start to do this when the player is 35 years old, 34 years old. There's no danger when he's a young player. Again, is there risk involved if he gets hurt? Yeah, sure. There's always going to be risk. But for the most part, this is about as risk-free of a decision as you can have for the Chiefs, you know, when it comes to doing that stuff. His contract is going to be looked at as so cheap a couple years from now. Nobody's going to care. You know, it's a great contract for Kansas City. Oh, speaking of which, I did mention this week that I was thinking of bringing back the best and worst contract series. I haven't done that in a couple of years. Usually I do it from a team perspective. Thinking I might do that again this summer just to have a little fun with it. We'll do a division each week and just go through. It's a little bit harder now only because the contracts aren't as – definitely not as bad as they used to be for the most part. And, you know, you plenty of stinkers. But they're not like historically bad. Maybe there's a couple. And the good contracts are harder to come by too. You know, the league has become so standardized that it makes it much harder to do that stuff. And what I found when I used to do them every year was it was a lot of repeat stuff. And for me, it's, I don't know, kind of boring to just always do the same ones over and over again, even though I guess it's a lot of times new people reading or you forgot about it from the year before. So, but I think I'm going to do that this year rather than just do a list of bad deals. I'll go team by team and we'll point out stuff that they negotiated that was pretty good and one that they did that I think wasn't. And usually when I do them, I'll try to do them without the hindsight analysis of it. Try to kind of put yourself more in the perspective of when the deal was done. But, you know, you'll take some hindsight stuff into account as well. All right, question from Brad here. Can you go over the benefits that players receive that are not salary related? Medical, retirement, tuition. I mean, there's a ton of stuff that are considered benefits on the NFL side. So for example, this year, I think if you get that 17th game check, if you're one of the players eligible for that, that counts as a benefit. They're not going to have them, but I think the performance-based pay, I think they have a rookie one. That's a benefit. The difference in the cap cost of those minimum salary contracts, the whatever they call them now, the veteran salary benefit and the qualifying player, that counts as a benefit for the league, for the players. You know, those are some of the ones that are there. I think the injury protection numbers, there's certain parts of that that count on the cap, and then there's certain parts of it that count as a benefit. I think it's like a 60-40 split or something like that. Obviously, the pension funding, you know, your workers' comp. There's pay for lodging and meals maybe in the off season for like OTAs. Maybe for preseason camp too. I think there's preseason stipends that you get. There's preseason pay, I think counts as a benefit. Postseason pay definitely does. So the money the players get to play in the postseason, those aren't salary cap related. Those go on a benefit side. Maybe moving expenses, did I mention that? So there's a lot of different stuff that's in there. Basically, anything that people bring up that when you hear about it that isn't really salary cap related or you don't see as being listed on the salary cap, basically that counts as a benefit. So there are a lot. So the benefit side of the equation, I'm trying to think of how much it typically is. I used to have a number that I would use, 15%. Maybe if the pool, it's like 85% goes to salary cap, 15% goes to benefits. So, I mean, it's not an insignificant number, you know, that's paid for benefits. I don't know if I have any of the ones. I'm just trying to see if I have anything where I have it listed. I remember this more from the the book writing. Let's see. Yeah, this is all from my little book era. But just to give you an example. So in 2016, the salary cap was 155.27. And there was about nearly $40 million paid in benefits. It's actually higher, I think, than I was thinking as to what it is. So, you know, that's how much? 20%? Yeah, so 20% of revenues goes to benefits. So it's not an insignificant number. It's a pretty high number, and it covers a lot of different things. So one of the ways that they offset a lot of that salary cap loss this year, and this is stuff that they've done before, what they do is they get rid of some of these performance pools, they defer them, they do other stuff like that. Basically, what they're doing is they're pushing money, you know, elsewhere instead of on the benefits side. Okay, let's see. This is from John. So I'm going to work with him on some stuff, which I will take a look at. Tomorrow I'm going to be out all day, but I probably won't post this till Sunday anyway. So Sunday I have a bunch of stuff to catch up on, hopefully. What's your take on the Colts' heavy use of one-year contracts? This has been a consistent pattern in the Chris Ballard era, and was wondering what you consider to be the pros and cons of that approach in free agency. So when it comes to Indianapolis, I think Ballard has a – well, there's two things. One, I think they're constrained with the money that they can spend. I truly believe that. They are one of the cheaper payrolls. They've been that way for a while. I think that there's a very clear, like, you can spend on a couple players, but if you have that money invested in those couple players, that should be enough kind of attitude. I kind of wish he would have more of a budget. And maybe I'm completely off base here, but I kind of wish he would have more of a budget to work with. I think the one-year contract thing is, you know, going back to what we did looking at free agency, you know, a lot of your return on those players in free agency is really just a one-year return. You know, most of the time after that first year that they're on a team, things start to go downhill. Oh, and most players don't make it to year three if you're talking about long-term deals. So I think he's probably taking the safe path. So I think for the long term, when you do things like that, it can probably keep you from ever, you know, really putting yourself, you know, kind of behind the eight ball cap-wise, let you consistently have the ability to move your roster, you know, to keep cycling in and out by doing stuff like that. So I don't think it's a bad idea that way at all. You know, we have seen them do a couple riskier moves of the one-year variety where you're looking to hit a home run with somebody. You know, who was the receiver they signed? Was it Funchess? Is that, I think he was still there. I think that was the one they signed. I think that was with him there. But anyway, I think it's a reasonable approach to how you want to build a team to continue to be successful. The thing is, you do miss out when you do that on that potential of getting that one higher end player that does happen to work out. Now, obviously, they made the trade last year, hoping that that would be the case. You know, so I think there is a risk there as well. You know, when it comes to this stuff, you know, there's always a risk involved. The thing is, if you make one risky pick, you know, if you make a risky choice in free agency, your thing there is you have to offset that with a couple of safe ones. I think where you miss out is where you just go safe, 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 safe. Sometimes you do miss out on hitting a bigger home run when that risky one does work out for you. You know, it's kind of like in the draft, you know, where you say, well, you know, you're always saying do things by the numbers, do things by the numbers. It's like, no, you know, there are times where you have to take a risk. The thing is, that risk has to work out to make it pay off. You know, it's like with the Falcons, you know, they take a tight end where they took him. He's got to be a superstar. He has to be the best tight end in the NFL. I'm not going to say in NFL history, but he has to be the best tight end in the NFL by next year and by a wide margin. I shouldn't say that. No, not by a wide margin, by a decent margin. You know, he's got to be the best tight end in the NFL. You know, you want to talk about him the way they talked about George Kittle 2 years ago. You want to be talking about him the way they talked about Rob Gronkowski in his years in New England, even if they're different types of players. You want to be talking about him with the way you talked about Jimmy Graham when Jimmy Graham was on the New Orleans Saints. That's what he has to be. You can take that risk. Just know it's a risk. That's all. You know, and if you're going to take a risk like that, offset it. You know, offset it with a couple of safe things. So I think that's what the Colts kind of miss out on is that they, the way that they do things makes you kind of think that they're going to be an organization that's always going to be like 9-7, 10-6, maybe even 11-5, you know, because they're in a bad division. Nothing that makes you think that they're going to have a year where they're 13-3 and you look at them as a legitimate Super Bowl contender. You just always look at them as like a wild card-ish kind of team that if they make it to the second round, probably doesn't have a prayer getting out of the second round. But they're going to be consistently like good, but never great. You know, kind of like the Bengals, you know, in the Andy Dalton years. Yeah, those are some pretty good teams. You know, then they had some bad injury luck with Dalton at the inopportune times. But, you know, kind of like teams like that. Like, they're better than the Vikings, but a team like the Vikings, you know, where there's just very, very limited upside. You know, it's maybe everything hits right and you get magic, but just kind of limited. All right, let's take a look. Go to Twitter. Just mentioned these earlier. Don't think there was too much. So let's take a look. Jason asks, if the Jets want to trade Jamison Crowder, when is the best time to do so? And what could they get for him? The same goes for CJ Mosley. I think the Jets should save money and roll it to next year. Then they can pay Quinnen Williams and have money left for the following year. So I think the best time to, well, the best time to trade Mosley is probably right at the trade deadline. Depends on how much money you're going to eat on him. Teams are going to want to watch Mosley play. Dude hasn't played football in like 3 years now. You know, I mean, he was off. He was hurt all of 2019. He took off in 2020. Yeah, I'm not getting that. You know, I won't say just took off. You know, it was the COVID thing was legitimate. The statement that he needed to refind his fire for the NFL should be concerning for every team in the league that would think about signing him. You know, he's got money guaranteed the following year. So I think he's going to have to prove he can play. You know, by playing until the trade deadline, that'll mean the Jets would have paid some of that money, probably pay a little of next year's money, and then you trade him. So around the same time, they traded Leonard Williams. I think with Crowder, the better time that I think they'll probably get more interest for him in the summer. You know, you look to see if somebody goes down. You look to see someone who wants to see where the rookies are at, or maybe their second-year players are at. And maybe after 2 weeks of camp, they're like, all right, this pick is going to bust. You know, this guy we had high hopes for is going to bust, or the high pick from this year, you know, he's just not ready yet. You know, he's not going to take that next step. We just want a steady veteran here. I think you might be able to find that in the preseason. Now, if you can't, then I think with him, again, you could hold out until the trade deadline. And then what you're looking to do is find, you know, a team that maybe didn't think they were a contender, but ended up being one. And then you trade him to a team like that. So I would hold on. I wouldn't worry about it. You know, if I get stuck with Crowder for the season, I get stuck with him for the season. I'd rather hold on to him at that $10 million that he's got this year coming to him with the assumption that I think there's, you know, 70% chance that you can move him if you want to. And I think that for the Jets, in this case, it's probably more valuable to be able to get a pick than just to save $10 million in cap space. I think there's more value for them in getting draft picks. Ken says, we regularly hear about post-June ones, but how much movement should we actually expect to have in the first week or so of June? Very little. The June 1 cut has meant almost nothing for the last 15 years, certainly the last 10 years. But probably like the last 15 years. Once teams started to get a little better with the salary cap, the June 1 was almost like a non-issue. There used to be a time where you did hold on to players until then. That was where they came up with this rule that you could designate somebody a June 1. And even that's barely ever used. Teams don't structure their contracts anymore to where this is really a concern. You don't see it. So I wouldn't expect it at all. I would just say that there are certain instances where, yeah, you waited, but I think it's more like a wait and see, meaning you wait until mid-August to see how your players are doing versus other stuff there. Oh, and you know, the other thing that reminds me of is James got released this week, as expected. You know, they did officially designate him as a June 1. I don't remember if I talked about that last week or not. I don't remember. He might have been released that day. The reason that they did a June 1, they didn't need to do a June 1 with him. The reason that they did that, just in the event, I don't think I talked about it, but the reason that they used the June 1 on him, let me just pull up his contract. It's because he will. I'm sure that they're certain that he's going to file a grievance. And what happens is the grievance hits the cap. You know, even if the guy ends up losing it, for a period of time, it's going to hit the cap. So basically what they're doing is deferring the $6 million. I think I mentioned this last week. You know, so it's it'll be a $3 million hit this year, $6 million next year versus the $9 million this year. But what's going to happen is he's got $15 million in injury protection and he'll file a grievance for that. And 40% of that will count. So $6 million will count on the cap. I may have talked about that last week. But in any event, that's why it's June 1 designation with him. Could you guys in the future work on an article where it can develop a sort of trade value chart for players, similar to what we have for trade value charts for draft picks, and makes it easier to value a guy like Julio Jones? That's a tricky one. Only because, you know, trades for veterans are complete diminishing return. It's not like a draft pick. You know, draft pick, you're drafting into a career. Trades for players, you're typically drafting into the end of a career. There's not even a lot of history with trades, and they're so wild, you know, because you get those Hopkins kind of trades and stuff like that. That's pretty hard to do, especially because a lot of teams might even look at this. You know, you look at the Broncos with Fuller. You know, they just signed him. You know, they didn't need a trade for him. You just sign him, you know, as soon as he gets cut. Now Jones isn't going to get cut, but that's a tough. I'd have to give that one a lot of thought to see how you could come up with a legitimate value, you know, for a player like that. That's a tough one to do. I mean, maybe there's some funky theoretical way you could do it, you know, tying it back to draft picks. You know, basically where you take something and you look at what the value of the player is. And the cost, you know, what the cost is, you know, to pay him, probably turn that maybe back into a draft pick number. I'd have to give that some thought. Okay, Stizo says, what is the range you see for the cap in 2022? OTC at the moment uses 203. Do you see that as the upper or lower bound of the realistic range? I think it's probably the upper bound. Now, it does look like stadiums are going to be full this year. You know, knock on wood, of course. You know, I think everyone feels pretty good about where we are right now with all the pandemic stuff. The only thing I'll say is last summer when everyone thought things were going to go really bad, they never did. So I don't know if, you know, we're all going to say that everything is, you know, all well and good, you know, based on the vaccinations and everything else. But I will say that things could possibly change, I guess, in September, October. Only because there's a seasonality to this, and we're assuming you threw everything, and you know, obviously compared to last year, I mean, this is night and day from where things were last March, April, even early May. But I don't know if in the next couple of months, given the way things went last year, and given that, I don't know if we can say for certain that come October, you're not going to end up getting some kind of out of nowhere shutdown stuff again. You know, I think that's happened in like Japan. I think that's happened in some of these other countries. So I think, you know, you just wait and see with that. But I think there's still a lot of money that the league lost last year that still is outstanding to be carried over. You know, the cap this year is, you know, 182-ish. I think the rumor mill basically said if no deal was struck, it would have been around 150, 155. So you could tell that means there's a lot of money that still has to be accounted for. So I think we're a ways away. 2022, 2023 is when you're going to see like kind of the new league when the cap jumps a little bit. And as Botanica, will our Jets ever sign a veteran quarterback to start or backup Wilson? Yeah, I'd expect they would. I don't think there's any chance they start a veteran. I think what they don't want is you don't want the Luke Falk situation where that's the kind of player that you wind up with coming on the field. Now, maybe there's some confidence in the kid they drafted last year, you know, as a backup. I'm not sure. But I do think that they will sign somebody before camp or trade for somebody. You know, I know we mentioned Foles before. You could look at the logjam of quarterbacks in Houston, you know, figure somebody's going to fall off from there. You know, those are kind of guys that you can get and bring in. But I don't think the Jets are looking to have anybody that'll start. It's only emergency starting. But I do think that there will be a veteran that's at least brought into camp until one of the young guys kind of proves they can or they cannot play, you know, with the team. And who knows? You know, who knows? Maybe they're even thinking if Jimmy Garoppolo gets released, that they can convince him to come in as a tutor for a year or something like that, since he's not going to have a chance to start by the time he gets cut. You know, that's who knows? Maybe that's even in the back of their head. Mike says, why does it take so long to sign the drafted rookies to contracts as the length and total costs are not actually negotiable? You know, there's little details that get negotiated, but I think for the most part, you know, teams want to hold on to their money. So in other words, if you sign a player and he's got a $20 million signing bonus coming to him, and you know that the payment schedule on that might be something like $5 million within 2 weeks of contract execution, $5 million when he reports to training camp, $5 million over the course of the season, and then the last $5 million lump sum comes, you know, the day before free agency begins, you know, something like that. Why pay that $5 million early if you can hold on to it in May and June and July? So I think that's part of it. I think some of it becomes a little bit of a posturing nonsense by some of the agents as well. You know, you're working on stuff, you're working this, you're working that, you're figuring out all these things with it when, you know, sometimes it's just saying stuff to say things. But there are a couple things that you do negotiate with them, you know, forfeiture language, payment schedules, for some of the later picks, maybe some split salary stuff, guarantee language, though that kind of falls under those forfeiture clauses. I mean, technically that's a voiding of a guarantee, but same type of stuff. You know, so I guess little things like that, you know, player appearances, you know, for a lot of that is probably pretty standardized, but those are little things that, you know, sometimes they go over, but I think most of the time it's just a money thing. What do you make of the Matthews situation in Kansas City? This is from Michael Becker. He's had some pessimistic tweets recently. What are the Chiefs' options there? What can they realistically do? This is sometimes what happens with players. And I can't say that I've followed it very close at all, other than I saw there was some tweet about the Cowboys or something today. You know, he wants an extension. This is basically what happens with players when they reach the end of a contract and they're still playing well. They want an extension. If you look at the way the Chiefs structured this deal, 15-8, 11-4, 14-8 are the 3 years, the cash payments. It was signed as a two-year deal with that third year as the question mark year. And I think by having a 14-8 salary in that season, you would say, okay, this salary is high enough to where he's not going to complain, you know, and he'll finish out the contract if we don't extend him. And I think that's probably what the plan was. And I think he's still looking for an extension. I don't think there's any way to placate the situation unless you want to extend him. And, you know, if I'm them, I probably wouldn't do it. I'd probably wait and see. You know, it costs a lot on the cap this year, but your cap is tight in the future. You've got to be cautious with some of the stuff you do. I don't think there's a need to sign him to like another three-year deal. Let it play out. You can tag him if you need to. So I think that's what it is. He's probably just unhappy. The league has pretty much blocked the ability of teams to hold out. So I don't think that's really an option for him. So this is one of those where I think if you're the team, you weather the storm, you hope it doesn't, you know, grow into like a giant hurricane of tweets and nonsense and all that kind of stuff. I think you just kind of weather the storm a little bit. And then once camp opens and people start getting into it, those things have a tendency sometimes to dissipate. David says, on last week's pod, you mentioned about the Panthers' terrible contract management. Can you expand on what the poor decisions are and why Washington are making some of the same mistakes? You know, the stuff that they did there were things like void years that were unnecessary. very, very, very high valuations of some of their players, especially running backs, doubling, tripling down on certain guys. It's the same structures you're seeing in Washington right now with those contracts that they're doing. You know, the guys they signed this year, all I think ended up with like void years and stuff like that in there. You know, Jackson's got two void years. It's like, why? You know, super high relative to the size of the contract, signing bonuses. They didn't need to do that this year. Their salary cap situation was not screaming for them to do that. That was Carolina. Carolina just doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on players when it came to their contracts. For guys that the general manager liked, pay them whatever they want. That seemed to be the way things went there. It was all salary cap be damned. Big signing bonus, big option bonus. Very old school. Very 2003-ish with the way they approached it. Left the team in shambles when it came to the salary cap when Gettleman took over. Gettleman drove it even further off, I think, there. You know, and they're still in a bind now in Carolina as they sort through. You know, they had to cut basically their whole defense 2 years ago. So it's been a mess there. And I see some of those tendencies already showing up in Washington. Now, we won't get an idea on the extension front for a little bit still. But I don't know. Some of the mechanisms that they're doing reminds me of stuff in Carolina. I'm assuming NFL teams have had interest in bringing you into their offices. If so, why haven't you joined a team? I'm sure a lot of teams could use you in their front office. I don't think there'd really be much interest. Would I be interested? Maybe. It would depend on the team and stuff like that. I kind of have fun doing what I'm doing. You know, there's no pressure. There's nothing involved. It's something I like doing kind of on the side. I enjoy talking about it, writing about it, and kind of bringing a little bit of a different perspective to it than, you know, the big talking head stuff that goes out there, which is a lot of times clueless on it, or at the very least, very misinformed, I think, when it comes to that. So I don't know. I have good relationships with a lot of guys on teams, but I've never really pushed on that at all. Like, hey, you looking for somebody? You know, it's not, you know, if this is, you know, it's one of those things I've said, if this was something that I did 20 years ago, you know, yeah, you would do that then, you know, because it's where you talk about risk, you know, it's a risky occupation of sorts, a lot of commitment, a lot of time, a lot of turnover. If you're lucky enough to get one of the positions, yeah, the cap positions do hold a lot firmer than other ones. You know, a lot of times you survive regime changes in the league if you do that kind of stuff. But, you know, there's a much more of a commitment. And I think that's much harder to do, you know, once you're kind of set a certain way and, you know, when you're married and the schedule that you're used to is very different than what it would be if you did that. If there was a local team involved, yeah, it'd be intriguing, but it's nothing I've really ever pursued. So, you know, and the other thing is just teams don't really invest that kind of time, I think, in a lot of the cap stuff. They do somewhat, and some teams invest a lot in it. But I think a lot of teams don't. You know, it's just kind of like one or two people, you know, some people working across, you know, various functions depending on their stuff. You know, they might double, you know, for people who actually work in legal, sometimes they'll double as like legal counsel for the team or they'll do a lot of their other stuff. It's not just NFL related stuff. So, yeah. That's that with that. Let's see the little response on that. We would miss him. It would be the end of OTC. That is true too. You know, if he ever did go and do something like that, that would be the end of OTC. You know, at least in the shape that it's in now. You know, there would be remnants of OTC. I think we've done enough with that to where there will always be remnants of it somewhere in some way, shape, or form. What would an extension for Gilmore look like? Top flight corner on the wrong side of 30. I don't think the Patriots would extend him. I mean, I think that would be insanity just for that reason that you mentioned there. You know, he's an older corner. I don't see that at all. I don't see a very lucrative market there. You know, he's going to look for 17. You know, Slay got 16.7, I think. You know, how old was Slay? You know, he was 30 or 29 probably last year when he signed that deal. And how old is Gilmore now? Yeah, Gilmore's already 31. So I'm sure that's what he's looking for. I think it would be insanity to do that kind of deal for him. You know, on the lower end, you know, Hayden was at 11. He was 30, I think, when he signed. You know, Chris Harris only got like 8.5. What did Kareem Jackson get? Did he get 11 when he moved to safety originally? Let me see. Now I should look this up on the back end instead of the front end, but let me look at his contract history. Yeah, he signed for 11. How old was he that year? That was in 2019 he signed. So he would have been 31. So, I mean, I think that's probably the more realistic market, 11 to 13. But I think he'd be looking for 17 to do an extension. Packer fan says, could you possibly quickly touch on the best non-rookie contract and worst non-rookie contract for the Packers right now? Why hasn't Lowry been cut yet? I think the Packers are just kind of biding their time with whatever they're going to do to create cap space. As for the best and worst deals on that team, let's take a quick look at them. Basically, has barely played a down on it, but I mean, the worst contract on the team is Bakhtiari, $23 million a year for left tackle. They gave credence to that Tunsil deal. Just not smart. 30 years old. He'll play out that deal. It's just wasted money. You know, they have so many other concerns. I understand that you wanted to keep him there. That number is absurd to me. Made no sense. So I think of the deals on the team, just at quick glance looking at it, I think that's the one that I would look at and kind of go with the what are you doing kind of deal. The Za'Darius Smith one has worked out really well in terms of the value of the player versus the production at the time. I think that was probably a very questionable deal, but that one worked out. You know, that's one of those deals where you took the risk and you got two pretty good years, I think, out of it. As for best contract, you know, I think your best contract on the team is Aaron Rodgers. You know, again, it's a situation where they would lock him up at the right times to where you make these deals very reasonable, you know, on your salary cap. You know, for the most part, I mean, you look at his deals, $20.9 million, $29 million, $21 million, and he jumps to $37 this year when the expectation was the cap was going to grow a lot. You know, and they had the flexibility to bring it down. They just chose not to because they want to keep the ability to trade him. So I think of the deals there, and yeah, you can question, you know, giving a big contract to a player who's 35 years old, even though at that position it is less risky. I think you look at the way they handled that deal, even with some of the crazy aspects of it, like the big signing bonus, which I think was pretty much unheard of at the time, because the Wilson one came a year after that, I think. This was probably a year after Stafford, so it was a little, you know, it was more than Stafford. I think you would still look at that as probably the best contract on the team. You know, if you wanted to go away from the quarterback, I'm not sure who I would choose if you went away from the quarterback. Davante Adams, I guess. You know, Davante Adams is a pure hindsight analysis kind of one. It's like the timing on that one was perfect for them. But I think it was perfect for, you know, the league. So they signed him in 2017, right? And at that point in time, he really hadn't had those, like, special seasons. You know, he was basically like a 1,000, you know, he was a sub-1,000 receiver, you know, good player. And I think his contract was right in line with market, and it was before the wide receiver stuff took this jump to where every wide receiver seemed to make a ton of money. So I think, you know, hindsight-wise, yeah, that's probably the best deal. I don't know. I'd have to think about that if I would look back on that and give them as big of a credit for that. I think the Aaron Rodgers thing is actually a little bit more challenging as a way to make a player the top paid at the position and kind of work through that, but it's got to be one of those two deals. I would just have to think about that a little bit. And I guess when I do the best and worst and I get to that division, I guess I'll decide between one of those two or something else there. What teams are the healthiest cap-wise? I think if you look now in the future, if you look at where teams are. I mean, your two healthiest teams with the cap are probably the Jets. Actually, the healthiest team with the cap is the Jets, because the Jets have a rookie contract, rookie quarterback, I mean, just like the Jaguars do. But the Jets next year have a projected $60 million in cap space. You know, it'll be less than that once a couple guys are under contract. Whereas the Jaguars are about $30 million less, because the Jaguars signed so many of these guys to kind of two-year deals in free agency. You know, the Jaguars do have more cap room than them right now, but I would say the Jets are number one. Jacksonville is probably number two. I think the Bengals are number three. I'm debating on the Broncos. Broncos are probably number four. The only thing with the Broncos is if the quarterback does work out, they are going to have to pay him a lot. Those are probably the top teams, though. Those are your teams that are best situated because of where they are with the rookie quarterbacks and their rosters right now. The dude says, can you walk through what you would have done differently over the last few years if you were the Packers GM to avoid the mess they're in? Well, I definitely wouldn't have re-signed Aaron Jones. I'd have to go back and look at some of the players. Like, I don't remember when they signed Jimmy Graham. That was a waste of time. And that should have been known to be a waste of time. I wouldn't have done that extension for Bakhtiari. I think the 17.5 for Kenny Clark, while reasonable within the market, I think it's questionable, is a strategy for building a team. Yeah, I wouldn't have done the Za'Darius Smith deal, and that would have been certainly a bad one for me. You know, I'd have to go back and look at some of the other stuff. But I mean, as far as the current things go, I mean, that's the stuff that I probably would look at and say, you know, those are things I probably wouldn't have done. But I can't say that would have, you know, the Aaron Jones one would have helped him a little bit. You know, I probably would have cut Preston Smith too. I don't think you needed to go through this whole keeping it. All right, let's take a look. Last two questions, I think, here. Football AGS, have you been offered a cap job in the NFL yet? So that was kind of what was asked before. And the answer is no, nothing in any kind of official capacity offered anything from a team to go and work there. In terms of just like asking questions on stuff and input and stuff like that, yeah, we've done things like that. But in terms of a job, no. What do you think it would cost the 49ers to trade for Jones? I don't think they have the cap space. Well, you know what? Yeah, I guess, you know, I say they don't have the cap room, but if they get rid of Garoppolo, they definitely would. You know, I would guess, being that it's in the NFC, I think you're going to ask for a one. I'm not sure if you're going to get a one, but I think if you're going to trade him to what would be considered a NFC rival, right, I think you're going to look for a first round pick. I think that's probably what you would do. So I think that's it for me. I'll be back hopefully next week. I got a couple things coming up that are going to be busy, but I'm sure I'll sneak in an hour or two for the podcast. So until next week, you guys all have a good week, and I will talk to you all again soon.